countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, looking ahead to World Bee Day. Fancy a job herding goats in Dublin? Brenda is in Rosslare for the reopening of caravan parks and mapping out the future of food production. Tom Arnold live in studio.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, as we look forward to restaurants and bars reopening, it's a race against time to find staff. And it's a problem for some farmers too, who are looking for seasonal workers. And Suzanne Campbell has been looking into this for us. Suzanne, good morning to you. Is there a huge headache looming for businesses?
Yes, Damien, good morning. There absolutely is, unfortunately. This has been coming to a head over the past few weeks. And it's not just in the food and the farming sector, restaurants and hotels. I mean, earlier in this week, it was reported that Dundrum Town Centre, the big retail outlet in Dublin, it has 500 to 1,000 vacancies to still fill before it can open fully. And they made that public, saying they desperately need people to apply for jobs. But in food and tourism, it's really been felt, as it's not just the busy season now, but hospitality, of course, is opening up again. Now, we've heard a lot about the PUP payment, or the PUP payment, some people call it, which workers have been given weekly if they lost their job during the pandemic. And this ranges from around 350 to a week down to 203 in some cases. Some businesses of all different types now are blaming the PUP payment for the reason people are not coming back to work. But it's more complicated than that, as most things are. If you look at the horticulture and soft fruit area, fruit pickers are largely from outside Ireland, and some of them have been delayed coming in, leading to labour shortages because of quarantine restrictions. But in terms of Irish recruitment on farms and in rural tourism businesses, it really has hit a crisis. I mean, I was talking to one Wexford strawberry grower yesterday, among many who are having problems getting employees. But he said he cannot find drivers and also people to man his strawberry stands at the side of the road, which he runs in various counties, quite a few of them. And this work is normally done by students. And I suppose angering a lot of businesses is hearing about workers that are still on the PUP payment, while businesses desperate for employees are also paying some of them cash in hand. I mean, I was told of one 19-year-old earning 350 a week on the PUP payment, but also getting 400 quid a week in cash from a business he's doing shifts at. So he's clearing 750 euros a week, which is 39,000 euro a year.
After tax.
I mean, this... you can just imagine the tax situation. I mean, this is the extreme of the situation, but there's all sorts of problems feeding into this mix. Cod Mushrooms in Tullow, run by Leslie Cod in County Carlow, they employ 250 people from packing to picking to drivers. They're still short 50 people, despite advertising widely in Ireland and in other European countries. I mean, we can blame the pandemic to a degree, but the flow of workers from Eastern Europe to Ireland, which began in the 90s to do farm work, much of this has really stopped. I mean, for countries, for example, Poland, they've experienced their own economic improvements. They have a shortage of workers as well. And now the people that come here from Poland are more skilled. They have degrees. They have very good English. So it's now countries outside the European Union that Ireland is looking to do horticultural work. Now, there was a permit system opened a couple of years ago for various sectors. Leslie was able to get workers from Asia in on this basis. New permits were to be launched at the beginning of the pandemic, but they were suspended because of the pandemic. This is early in 2020. Leslie feels that unless these permits are granted again to workers in third countries, that businesses like his are in serious trouble.
We have been trying to recruit the last few months in earnest, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to get Eastern European people, and there's no chance of getting Irish staff. They just don't want to work in this industry. So it would be a perfect situation for us to have the permit system opened up again We got in 69 Thai people in the last 2 years when the 500 permits were launched. So we would like that to be reopened again to be able to get up to 50 people immediately.
And so even though we might be looking at high unemployment figures, you're actually finding there's a labour shortage.
Yeah, I think a lot of companies are experiencing a labour shortage. A lot of hotels that were closed have to pretty much restaff the place. I'm talking to a few people in the hotel and restaurant industry, and they're seeing about half the staff that they originally had will come back, and the other half of either, if they were not from Ireland, they may have gone back to their native country, or they're happier to stay on the PUP scheme, unfortunately. We don't really have a situation where we had staff that we had to let go and now we're trying to encourage back. We stayed at full tilt all the way through the pandemic. And it's just from a natural losing of staff, 5 or 10% per year, we're just finding it extremely difficult to recruit. Certainly, Irish horticultural firms are finding it quite difficult. And the lack of having permits then leaves us in a kind of a block that we don't know what to do. We're very much in a dire situation at the moment.
You're not suffering from employees who don't want to come off PUP, but are you hearing that around other farms or other people in similar businesses?
Yeah, outside our industry, I'm hearing a lot of issues with especially hotel owners that are anxious to get going again and open up when they're allowed to open up, and having a huge problem recruiting staff. Like, it's not only recruiting staff, it's training staff, and they're not getting the numbers that they expected to get back from their that they previously employed. They've moved on and maybe want to change career, but a lot of them don't want to come off the PUP scheme. My opinion would be they need to stop that PUP scheme as quickly as possible.
Now, there's still thousands of people depending on the PUP who have no work, and in sectors that will be the last to open, like events and conferences, etc. But in terms of other businesses really hit by labour shortages, hotels and restaurants are the really big ones. With no days yet for the opening of pubs, those in that trade tell me the situation is exactly the same. Finding chefs in Ireland has been an issue now for several years, even before the pandemic. Now it's a bit of a crisis, and chefs and restaurants owners told me during the week that it's likely to prevent some of them actually reopening. But all types of workers are in demand and they're frantically recruiting. I talked to Adrian Cummins this week of the Restaurant Association of Ireland, and he said that 25% of the workers who were in hospitality before the pandemic are now gone from the sector. I asked him what he's hearing from restaurants in terms of the people they are short of.
Obviously, chefs is the number one, but they can't find waiters, waitresses, bar staff, managers. It's very, very difficult to try and find enough staff to run the businesses on, let's say, full tilt. When we're allowed to reopen indoors, and we believe that will be in July, but when our industry is back open fully, you know, there is going to be a huge deficit of skilled labour, and every business is being affected. It doesn't matter what part of the country you're in, everybody has the same narrative. I can't find a chef, can't find a waiter, can't find a bar staff. And I haven't seen this in 25 years of my career in hospitality. Basically, it's like a famine.
What do you put it down to? I know that PUP payment is blamed in some respects, that maybe people kind of under 25 on the payment don't want to go back to hours where they were on minimum wage and not making much more than the payment. Other European staff went home during the pandemic, which is totally understandable.
There's a number of factors at play here. So we're a multinational sector. We have people from all parts of the world living and working in Ireland prior to COVID. Some of those employees have travelled back home to their home countries. And obviously we've lost those. We've also lost a certain percentage of our employees to other sectors that will not return into our industry. So we need to backfill those positions, and that is a challenge for us. We're trying to rebuild an entire sector of the economy within Ireland, and we need everybody on the same page. We need the government definitely on the same page as employers, and we need to be imaginative, progressive, and we need to help fast track the re-employment of employees as quickly as possible. And obviously, you know, if somebody is being offered a job, we hope that those employees take up that job as quickly as possible.
That's Adrian Cummins there, the Restaurant Association of Ireland, ending that report from Suzanne Campbell.
Tá feibogan ye imagine le line mach go will sire touchem go dochroch an show an yeran agus ar fod na crinne.
We that our wild bees are threatened with extinction. And we also know that our common bumblebees are also declining in abundance.
They don't have enough places to live or things to feed on. We're also being hampered by disease, by pollution, by climate change. And it just seemed to us like we needed to do something. We needed to take action. And that's where the pollinator plan was born from.
Well, this Thursday is World Bee Day, and you heard a clip there from a T.G. Cahir documentary, which is airing on Thursday, Plan B, with gorgeous close-up photography helping to tell the story of the important role of the bee. Now, included in the interviews are Professor Jane Stout, a botanist from Trinity College in Dublin, with Una Fitzpatrick of the National Biodiversity Data Centre. Jane is the founder of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, and she joins me now. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
How many different species of bees are there buzzing around the country?
Well, in Ireland, we've 99 different species. Worldwide, there's 20,000 different species, which usually surprises people because they've mostly just heard about the honeybee, which is just one single species. So in Ireland, we've 99 species. That's the one species of honeybee, 21 species of bumblebee, and 77 species of solitary bee.
And they're threatened by disease, pollution and climate change. How large is that threat right now?
Unfortunately, it is quite serious. So we did a formal assessment of the conservation status of Ireland's bees in 2006. And what we concluded from that was that 30% of our Irish bee species were actually at risk of extinction. And that was that's a huge proportion, 30%, a third of all of our species. And it was from that we decided that we needed to do something. We needed to take action.
And will you just explain to us how pollinators are so crucial to human survival and why we need to arrest this problem?
Yeah, I mean, bees are fantastic pollinators because as they visit flowers to collect food for themselves, so they feed on nectar and they collect pollen to feed to their offspring. As they gather that food, they move from flower to flower and bring with them the pollen. Because plants can't move to find a mate in the same way that animals can, this is really important in the reproduction of plants. So the pollen moving from flower to flower fertilizes the flowers and allows the plants to produce seeds to the next generation. So it's really important for some plant species that have no other way of reproducing. And that includes some of our crop species. So things like apples. I think apples is a great example because if you don't have bees moving pollen between apple flowers, then you don't get the production of a fruit. You don't get the apples. And it's been estimated that 75% of human food crops are animal pollinated, and a lot of those are pollinated by bees. So their contribution towards our diets, towards food, towards the agricultural industry are really, really important. But beyond that, they're also really important for pollinating lots of other plant species that are of value to us. So species that produce timber or fibres or medicinal products. And they're also really important in the wider countryside for pollinating. 90% of our plant species on the planet are animal pollinated. So they're really, playing a really crucial role in our natural ecosystems. And that contributes to all the other benefits that we get from ecosystems, including climate regulation, including clean air and water purification and all the rest of it. So they really are really important parts of terrestrial ecosystems.
Yeah, and was it Einstein that said if the bee disappeared off the face of the earth, man would only have 4 years left to live, I think was the quote or something that, like that.
It's a very famous misquote. Right. Einstein apparently never ever said that, but an indication of how important they are for us indeed.
Well, I'm sure he taught it anyway in his own. Now, but for all of us listening to you now, Jane, thinking that this is sad and terrible and God, we must do something about it. In the documentary, you and Una are at pains to make the point that indeed every one of us listening can do something.
Absolutely. And that, I think that's something that's really important about the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, is that we've developed it in such a way that everybody can do something. So, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, the main problems with that are driving pollinator decline are homelessness. So they've got nowhere to live. They're hungry. They've not got enough food. They're threatened by disease, by pollution, and by climate change. Now, it might be that an individual thinks they can't possibly do anything to tackle massive problems like climate change or pollution. But individuals can help to provide shelter and to provide food. So, you know, if you've got a back garden, you can provide food in the form of flowers. You can provide undisturbed areas that bees can nest in. And it's not just in your back garden. So what we've done with the Pollinator Plan is to develop tailored, targeted sectoral guides. So there's guidelines for businesses, for local communities, for farmers, for gardeners, you know, so everybody can do something. And if it's as small as planting some herbs and putting them in a pot on your balcony, or if it's as large as managing your local park or your farm or your roadside verges in a more pollinator friendly way, everybody can do something and everybody can take part. And I think, you know, listeners might have noticed the Pollinator Plan signs popping up all over the place, where local community groups, tidy towns, local councils are all getting involved in reducing the intensity of management of open spaces to leave space for nature.
Yeah, and a lot of those points are really well made in what is a beautiful documentary on T.G. Cahir, which I had the pleasure of watching. Really is really well shot and such a lesson to us all. And you do indeed speak to and highlight people of all walks of life and what they're actually doing to try and as I said, reverse the problem. And it's not too late for us to reverse it. Just remind us again, Professor Stout, when is the documentary airing?
It's airing on Thursday evening, so Thursday the 20th, which is World Bee Day, on T.G. Cahir.
At 9:30 p.m. in the evening. It's been lovely chatting to you. Keep up the good work there with the Pollinator Plan, the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, which you're very much involved with. And thanks for chatting to us and have a great weekend. That's Professor Jane Stout, who's a botanist there with Trinity College in Dublin.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.
Yes, I'm getting a lot of texts and tweets from people annoyed that there would be any allegations made against young people not wanting to work, and people saying that if people were paid the proper living wage, they would be enticed to go back to work. So that certainly has generated a lot of discussion this morning. Now, we've seen the devastating impact of gorse fires in Wicklow, Kerry and the Mourne Mountains this year. And as the weather gets hotter, the risk of fire in gorse and on the hillsides is even greater. But could the answer lie with goats? Well, the Old Irish Goat Society is based in Mulroney, County Mayo, and it's collaborating with Fingal County Council to graze the extreme headland vegetation of Howth Head in Dublin. It, in grazing the firebreaks and reducing gorse cover, they serve an important conservation role. But they need somebody to herd these goats when they bring them to Dublin later in the summer. Sean Carlin of the Old Irish Goat Society spoke to me a little earlier.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hood, lay, hood, lay, hoo-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, hood, lay, hood, loo.
The Old Irish Goat, it's a prehistoric breed of goat in Ireland, and it was largely forgotten about. And we started to look for the goat to see if it still existed. And we found some goats in Mulroney in County Mayo in 2011. And over the last 10 years, we've been working intensely to, you know, to genetically profile them to document their physical features. And we're still working towards native breed recognition at the moment.
And tell me a little bit more about the goat and, I suppose, their contribution to the environment.
The Old Irish Goat came to Ireland pre-Neolithic, and it's a land-raised breed. So what that means is it can survive on the landscape without any supplementary feeding. It's, I suppose, a large hoofed animal, and it helps keep uplands and heathlands clear of scrub and and overgrowth. And so it provides a functional service. It's also particularly good at grazing gorse, which is quite a flammable plant, and therefore, you know, the Old Irish goat has very significant functional ability as well, and that's something that we're trying to explore here and demonstrate on this project in Howth Head.
Okay, so about that project in Howth Head, tell me a little bit more about what you're trying to do there.
Well, we're trying to, I suppose, first of all, make the headland safer from a fire risk point of view. That's to try and reduce the amount of scrub and potential fire material on Howth Head. But also, grazing will bring significant biodiversity benefits. It'll help pollinators by reducing the amount of woody material that's on the heathland. It's a three-year project, and we're also going to be demonstrating some new technology in Ireland there, the Nordic no-fence system, and seeing how that works in terms of managing the goats.
And speaking of managing the goats, that's exactly what you're looking for, somebody to look after them.
Yeah, so what we're offering here is essentially a three-year role. The salary is €45,000 a year. The person would be skilled in animal husbandry, have experience in that. And what I suppose we're looking for them to do is form a team, if you like, with the goats to go out onto the heathland. The goats will graze off some of the undergrowth. We want this person to maybe help them clearing some of the more woody stuff and bring goats back into a field or a shed at night. So take care of goats, get out onto the beautiful Howth Head. Another aspect then is to engage with the community, keep them informed, and probably some social media work as well in terms of publicising the project.
So who is your ideal candidate? What sort of a person would suit this job?
Well, someone who has worked with goats, ideally, or upland sheep, that has skills with a sheepdog would be ideal, and someone that's enthused about conservation, enthused about the environment, likes the outdoors, and is practical, and has their own initiative, and would be you know, good to work with people.
And you can get more details about that job by going to their website oldirishgoat.ie and click on jobs. That's oldirishgoat.ie for further information. Now, last year, around €13 billion worth of food and drink produced in Ireland was exported across the globe. For example, over 80% of the beef and dairy products produced on Irish farms is consumed abroad. Strategy 2030 is the title of a blueprint mapping the future direction of food production from farm to fork. A committee was established early last year, which includes many stakeholders involved in farming and food production, although the environmental pillar, which was part of the committee, withdrew earlier this year. Nevertheless, a draft copy of the Agri-Strategy's proposals has been published and is now open to public consultation until the middle of next month. The chairman of the Strategy 2030 committee is Tom Arnold, and he's here with me in studio. But first, I've been getting reaction to the draft report. Sive O'Neill is the policy coordinator of Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, whom we will hear from presently. But first, here's Tim Cullinan, president of the Irish Farmers Association.
This strategy is all around sustainable food production, and you know, we all strive to do that, Damien. And if you look at the three pillars of that stool, you have economic, social and environmental. And what I critically have to see coming out of this is that it is economical for farmers to produce food, and farmers have to be able to get a margin out of this. If we look at it at the moment, the share of the food chain value that farmers are getting has decreased from 20% in 2008 to approximately 18% now. And you know, that's not good enough, because farmers are out there doing the work, doing a lot of environmental good, and they have to get paid for that.
Well, we're quite disappointed with it. It's an industry-led process that we see as designed to continue with a business-as-usual model with very little deviation from the previous strategies, which have let us down in terms of their environmental impact. We feel that environmental and climate interests and also expertise were largely excluded or sidelined in the pursuit of this model, which is based on intensive farming and exports. So the focus is on production efficiency and maximising those, but it doesn't properly recognise catchment, biodiversity and climate constraints. It does propose a methane cut, but this is insufficient.
The money that farmers have been obtaining from Brussels for producing cheap food over a long number of years has been eroded, and that money now is being used for environmental good, which we have no problem with environmental good, but there has to be more compensation and there has to be more funding made available for farmers to comply with what we're looking at as Ag Strategy 2030 and what's coming down the road in Climate Action Bill as well.
Well, the most important thing is that we need a new roadmap for agriculture and food that's aligned with our climate, air, water and biodiversity commitments. And these are kind of inescapable, legally binding commitments. We also want to see a just transition model to help farmers in adapting and also diversifying. And that's going to require change in approach at a sectoral level and also at a farm and a catchment-based level. And we see the role of the Common Agricultural Policy here as very important. It's going to be critical to support more food security and localised food production here in Ireland, and instead of just promoting cheaper exports.
Dairy farmers are working along the advice that they're receiving from Chagas, our state body. You know, I mean, we have the MAC curve. We're looking at different methods of farming with the way organic fertiliser applied to the lands with the low emission slurry spreading, which is a decrease in ammonia, looking at the fertiliser that has been used as well, the volume of fertiliser being put on lands, obviously getting more efficient use out of that. And I think working with that MAC curve, and I think we can achieve the reductions that we need to do without looking at the herd. Because look, dairy farmers in particular have invested well in excess of $2 billion over the last number of years since the abolition of quotas, along with what has been invested by the co-ops as well. So that's a substantial business, and that business has to be protected into the future. And, you know, it's critical that we keep farmers alive in rural Ireland. Every town and village in the country is gaining from what farmers have been doing, and, you know, government needs to remember that as well.
The contribution of beef and dairy cows to greenhouse gas pollution is not the same. Dairy cows emit about 2.5 times more methane. So you can't grow the dairy herd without major reductions in the beef herd. For every extra dairy cow you add to the herd, you need to take out 2.5 beef cows. So we need to have an honest conversation about the trade-offs here, because if we protect the dairy herd and abandon the beef sector, that's going to deal with the climate problem, perhaps, but it won't deal with our water quality and biodiversity problems in the south and southeast of Ireland. So we need to see a modelling exercise carried out that will tell us the optimum number of cattle that meets all of those climate constraints and also the water, air quality and biodiversity constraints. So I think looking to the future, we're going to see a more diversified agricultural sector, less dependence on livestock overall, more horticulture, more tillage, more localised food production with an emphasis on premium, organic and low input products, more agroforestry and more forestry, because that is a key part of the land use debate.
That was Sy Vanille of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, and before that, Tim Cullinan, President of the IFA. And joining me now in studio is Tom Arnold, who is the Chairman of the Agri Strategy 2030 Committee and who's been with us before. Tom, good morning. Good to have you back.
Thank you, man.
Could you explain to listeners why this strategy is so important?
It's so important because the world we're moving into over the next decade is very different than the world of the past. We've had 5 of these strategies since 2000. They've all been of their time, if you like. But this one is, you know, we set out with a different set of both national and global priorities that have to be met. So the terms of reference we were given was to come up with a vision for 2030, which had the agri-food sector delivering on sustainability in its 3 dimensions: economic, environmental and social, and to come up with the policies that would get us there. So that was, you know, our central purpose. I think we've delivered on that central purpose. And the way we went about it was, at our very first working meeting in January of last year, we agreed to adopt what's called a food systems approach, which said we would, at the beginning, we would recognise that policies for food, the environment and health had to be fully recognised and interconnected. And we would also recognise that it was the whole of the sector that had a responsibility towards developing a sustainable food system, from the input supplier to the farmer, to the processor, to the retailer, to the citizen and to the consumer. And the message which kept coming through as we were doing our work from the whole wider sector was that sustainability is now what the citizen and the consumer wants, both domestically here in Ireland and internationally. And we had to produce a strategy which met that basic requirement. Well, and that, I think, is what we've done.
Yeah, and the various strategies over the last 20 years, though, they've seen an exponential increase in exports abroad and new markets discovered all over the world for Irish food and produce. I presume that's also part of the aim over the next 10 years, to consolidate those markets and find new markets. But if you're increasing output, does it not fly in the face of all of the environmental requirements that are needed over the next 10 years to be met in agriculture?
Well, first of all, I think we're at a stage where we're not going to be increasing output at anything like the same level as we have done in the past. That's a basic issue. But we have legitimately developed and done it very well, export markets in many countries. And the demand for the type of food that Ireland is producing, safe, environmentally sustainable food, the demand for that is growing. And I think Ireland can meet that demand indeed well over the next number of years.
So the demand for dairy and beef protein is growing, you're saying, globally?
Of course it's growing. It's growing because in the next up to 2030, world population is going to increase by about 2 billion. And a lot of those people are going to become better off and are looking to have better diets. And part of those better diets is indeed more consumption of animal protein. And we acknowledge in our strategy that in the developed parts of the world, there is indeed a case for reduction in meat, particularly processed meats, for in the interest of health. But in about the 2/3 of the world's population, which are growing, which are becoming more prosperous, there is a demand for more animal protein products, safely produced, environmentally produced,
yes,
and indeed necessary for the improved nutrition of these people in developing countries.
Okay, so isn't that at the crux of this argument in relation to carbon leakage, where on the one hand, if demand is increasing globally for beef and dairy, the argument is made from farmers that, well, we do it sufficiently, we do it in an environmentally friendly sort of manner. And then the environmental argument is that that's a vexatious argument to say that just because we are doing it in a more environmentally sustainable manner, that if we don't produce that food, it'll be produced elsewhere. Isn't that the crux of the discussion going forward about where we go with dairy and beef production?
It's to some extent has the crux, but to some extent this is a theoretical argument. If the world were to be rational and say, you know, we can look at the whole carbon, global carbon budget, then the carbon leakage issue comes into play. But the reality is that that's not how the world is currently organised. And how the world is currently organised is that there are clear targets, environmental targets, both in Europe and in Ireland, which now have to be met. And that's what we set out clearly in the strategy. We are saying that, and everybody around the table accepted that environmental sustainability had to be a core part of the vision for the future, but aligned with a balanced view with both economic and social environment, social sustainability. And that's what we've done. I think we've put together both a coherent and an ambitious strategy, which, if it's delivered upon over the next decade, is going to meet the needs of the Irish people and also position Ireland as a real leader in the whole area of sustainable food systems. And that's particularly important given that, you know, in September of this year, we are going to have a food system summit in New York, summoned by the UN Secretary General, which I think is going to get a great deal of attention and which Ireland is in a good position to make a really substantial contribution at.
Is your report, is it somewhat damaged by the fact that the environmental pillar did leave the committee?
We were very disappointed that the pillar left the committee. Their representative, Karen Chilskelsky, had made a really important contribution over the period from January of last year until they decided to leave in February of this year. But I think the lessons, Karen had made her point, but everybody around the table, I think, was conscious, including the farm organisation, was conscious of the importance of the environment for this strategy. And if I could just maybe quote the first paragraph in our executive summary, which I think sets it out well. It says, this strategy recognises that there needs to be a profound shift towards more sustainable policies and actions nationally and internationally. The Dáil has declared a climate and biodiversity emergency. Decisive action is required to implement the legislative arrangements to act on this. The world needs to get back on track to meet the commitments of the Sustainable Development Goals, the Paris Climate Agreement and the Global Convention on Biodiversity, and move towards more sustainable land use, production and consumption practices. Now, that's the basis on which our strategy is built.
But as we heard Simon Neill say there, the interests and expertise were largely sidelined of the environmental pillar.
I don't believe that's correct. We had indeed a substantial other environmental voices. We had, for example, Professor Frank Convery, who's an internationally recognised environmental scientist. And we have other people who are not, if you like, labelled environmentalists, but who have environmentalists on board. So I think all of that fed into what is there. And I think there's a very strong section in the document about what needs to be done to achieve environmental sustainability. But it is side by side with a strong chapter on what needs to be achieved to attain an economic environmental sustainability and also social sustainability. And just this week, we had the National Competitiveness Council talking about, you know, the change that we as a society are going to have to make in terms of work practices, etc., etc. So real opportunities, I think, for regional and rural Ireland. So I think what we have put together is a balanced approach towards the future. And I think, as I said, we want it debated. It has been debated through a series of some very interesting national food dialogues, and what was said in those dialogues, and indeed a very useful additional document from the environmental pillar, which they published after we published our report. All of that will be taken into account as we work towards finalising the strategy from mid-June onwards.
And can listeners listening now, can they have their input?
Very much so. I mean, that's the whole point of the public consultation approach. I mean, I have to say that I've been very disappointed over the last few months about the tone and the quality of the both political and public debate about these matters. Because I think what it doesn't recognise is the considerable level of common ground that there is between the two sides of this debate.
And that's it's really bitter.
And it has got to a point where it's completely unnecessarily divisive. And I think we need to get to the point where we need to find that common ground and build on it rather than narrow it down. And that's the basis we took in our strategy, because what we have done is set out a set of measures which, if implemented, will show that it's the agri-food sector has a crucially important role in addressing the climate and biodiversity challenge that we face, and they have to be brought on board to do this.
Okay, and indeed everybody working together, as some people in the more moderate middle are actually saying online. Tom, thank you very much for coming in to studio, and as I said, and I often say when we discuss this, it's a subject we will come back to and discuss and debate as things move on, but that public consultation is open until the 15th of June. Now, after so many months of restrictions, among many of the freedoms this week gone, owners of stationary mobile homes or caravans can now travel to another county and indeed stay in their own mobile home. Well, Brenda Donoghue, she dusted down her flip-flops and paid a visit to the Central Holiday Park, a caravan owner-only plant park in Rosslare, County Wexford.
Okay, Cullen, pass the ball over here. Good boy, well done. Emmett and Grainne. Are you thrilled to be back here in Rosslare and at your mobile home?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic to be back down, you know. All you have to do is look around. You see all the kids out playing. It's just fantastic. And we have this all year round.
Why a mobile home? Why did you decide that for your family?
It started with a pretend weekend away, and I told Emmett in the car on the way, by the way, we're actually going for one weekend and possibly more, because I said, we've bought this mobile home. I hadn't even told him. And here we are 9 years later, and he always says, oh my God, it was the best thing you ever did. So, I mean, it's a lifestyle in itself. When you come in the gate, you leave all your worries behind, and just the kids have the freedom. Let the hair down and relax and breathe.
Can I ask, when you heard the COVID restrictions were being lifted, that you could come down, how did you feel and what did you think?
I was brought back to when I was a child and you were counting down the days literally for your holidays. What's the first thing you're going to do when you come down? Apart from cracking open the wine, of course. Just really, really excited.
But it's funny enough when you say that, we've actually gone on many holidays abroad. Even though they were great holidays and great memories, the holidays that the kids actually keep referring to and always allude to are the holidays in Rosslare. It's really like where we were, going back to basics, spending your holidays in Ireland. It's brilliant. We love it.
Hi, Brenda. My name is Carol. I'm delighted to be back in my mobile home, my happy place, with the sun shining today.
You're in a summer dress.
Yeah. We're feeling back and just waiting on kids to arrive and family to arrive and just to have a happy weekend and just a normal weekend.
COVID has brought many challenges to people. How have you managed? You're on a walker. What's your story?
I got COVID. Yeah. I got COVID and couldn't walk really. Just the leg kept going. Like the balance was gone. So I'm out with this constitutional this morning.
I said
if I can get around, I'll be happy. I'm back.
When you heard the news that you could go back to your mobile home, how did you feel?
I cried. I'd forgotten what I looked like when I went into it. It was like, yes, this is it. We're home.
Being able to come back here to your mobile, do you think that will help you in your recovery from COVID?
Very much so. Because I'll make myself get out of my pajamas and I'll make myself walk. When you get COVID and when COVID is around you, you've only one life. So you better live the rest of it quick. And that's why I think is making me out of my PJs this morning and in my little dress and off with my scooter.
Hi guys, great to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm now being met by Geraldine Mourne Galvin, Central Holiday Park Managing Director. This is a family business, Geraldine.
Yes, Brenda, it is indeed. We've been in the family business here for over 45 years, originally established by my late father, Marky Mourne. And absolutely, we're still here, thank goodness. This year with the pandemic, we're preparing for a very busy summer also, because this is where people can go and this is where they're happy to go at the moment, you know, until restrictions ease. I hear from our mobile home suppliers too, it's just so busy. It really has put mobile home parks on a different level completely. There's more inquiries, people want to upgrade their mobile homes. So much now there's actually beginning to be a shortage of supply of mobile homes due to demand. So yes, it is. It's becoming very popular.
Restrictions are lifted. What a busy week it's been with everybody returning to their mobile homes here.
Ah, Brenda, it's been fantastic. Since, you know, the gates of the park were open at 9:30 a.m. on Monday, the 10th of May, and the cars were flowing in, the people were coming down, and you could just see they were so happy. It's lovely to have everybody back.
How are you, Tara? How are you today? And welcome back.
Hiya, Peggy. How are you? How's things?
Good. Hello, Brenda. Welcome to my abode.
Peggy, how are you? What's your second
name? I'm good. My name is Barry.
And where are you from?
I'm from Talla in Dublin.
Do you mind me ask how old you are, Peggy?
I'm 81 this year.
How has COVID been for you and the restrictions? Was it difficult not coming here? Overall, how have you been?
I was brokenhearted when I couldn't come down. I had to wait till it officially opened. And here I am, and I'll be here to the day it closes.
What was it like coming back? That feeling of coming into the mobile home, of restrictions being lifted?
Well, I was very depressed, and I only got through it now with my family. I wasn't out of the house. I never seen a shop even till I got the injections. But I prayed for the day that the park would open. I absolutely love it. And when I came down here, it all lifted. I'm as free as a bird, ready to take off. Well, I love to come down. I love to read. I love to do jigsaws. Brenda, I'm a big fan of the charity shops. You never know what you pick up in them. Yeah. Look at that lovely clock.
That's lovely, yeah.
€2. And I've got all me little ornaments in the charity shop. Yes.
So you kind of decorated the mobile home from all
the yes, bits. I did, yes. Yeah.
Can I just look at your deck here?
Well, I'm doing it all. I have to paint it this year. I paint it nearly every year myself. So I enjoy doing it and putting up all the little things and making it nice and comfortable for myself. What else could you ask for, Brenda? What else could you ask for in this world?
If you could only bottle that enthusiasm and happiness there of Peggy Barry ending that report in Rosslare from Brenda Donoghue. Brings the programme to an end for this week. Playback's up after the 9 news. Until I talk to you at the same time next week. Bye-bye and thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.
RTE Radio 1.